Testing, 1, 2, 3.
Ron Hansen. Writers at Work would like to thank the English Department and the Poetry Center for helping us put this on, and a special thanks to Lois Shelton for a lot of direction. There'll be punching cookies after this. Our first reader will be Jean Rukila. Jean is a graduate student in creative writing here at the university. She has a degree in journalism from Arizona State University, and she works in the summer in lookout towers out in the forest. Our first reader is Jean Rukila.
I was perfectly prepared to be terrified tonight. I mean, I was almost looking forward to experiencing fear of public speaking, but then this half the neighborhood I grew up with in Phoenix showed up, and somehow that cheering section just kind of puts me right at ease. Okay, oh, maybe I can stand closer. How do you turn it up? Okay. How's that? Better? Better? I've found myself thinking about my sister in the last week or two. She recently moved to Connecticut to live on a farm with her husband. And I keep getting these letters about how she's taking care of her sick pigs and raising big vegetables in her garden. And it all seems pretty foreign to me. I think she'd probably find it foreign to see me standing up here with my hair combed, reading my fiction aloud to the public. It used to, make me nervous or set me on edge to imagine that my family would become strangers to me as we all got older and led our different lives. But lately I've found myself thinking of it as being kind of interesting, really. It's like reading a very, very long novel that you can hardly put down. So with my sister, my twin sister Joyce, in mind, I'd like to read this story tonight called Andy and Ann. I'm up a tree with my cheerful independence, trying to figure something out. And because I can't, I'm staying entertained by spying on my mother and sister below. I scrape my elbow getting here. It stings, and the feel of it reminds me of being a girl, how I was often too busy keeping up with the boys to stop for small injuries. I'm not a girl anymore, but I'm still girl enough to be comfortable sitting in the fork of this mulberry, leaning against a branch, enjoying a crisp December Phoenix day. My sister is the quiet Ann, and I'm the less quiet Andy. I've always figured my parents had a boy name and a girl name picked out, and when they had twins, they changed the Y to I and used both names anyway. It turned out the boy's name fit me. I was the twin who usually had one knee sock sagging, especially in the school class picture. I was hard of hearing at supper time. I was the twin who threw the softball farther, punched more often, and had blacker moods. Mom doesn't remember why I became Andy and Ann was picked to be Ann. She does remember that we blinked quite alike and had our own language when we crawled around the house. We put off learning to talk, content with our very own combinations of eye contact and nonsense words. Mom is 63 and Ann and I are 30. It may be odd to sit around in a mulberry tree on a working day, but I'm not crazy. I'm just Andy, a reasonably respectable teacher of 8th grade English. People are usually impressed by my competence in the classroom. I have a new car, a subscription to New Yorker, and season tickets to the local theater group. I also have this streak that sends me splashing right through the rain puddles in the parking lot, especially when I know my students are looking, and up trees on a whim when I visit my mother. It is shirt sleeve weather, but there's a possibility of frost tonight, so Mom is stripping the tangerine tree. She reaches into the tree with one hand and holds a paper sack with the other. She can't quite reach the last of the bright orange balls at the top of the little tree. In my sister's yard, there are sheets draped over the wire clothesline. They slowly fill with the sighing breeze, and the way they move, standing out a bit, makes me think I'm in the crow's nest at the top of a square rigger, judging the sails below. There's a hedge that separates Ann yards from Mom. They don't see each other, and they don't see me. Ann has the hiccups. I can hear her from here. She's being very loud with those hiccups because she doesn't think anybody is listening. They soften, those great plopping, tuneful gasps of air, when she hears my mother crumpling a paper bag in the next yard. I watch Mom's tennis shoes bobbing through the wet grass. I hear the note of inquiry in my sister's voice and the rising and falling pitches of Mom describing things. Ann is hanging up her husband's shorts now. There they are in a line, the new white shorts, the shorts with the holes in them, and the ones that got a little pink. Probably when I volunteered to do their laundry with mine and mixed in a new red sweatshirt. That line of wet shorts leap out at me as some kind of symbol of married life. Symbol often leaps out at me, I guess, because I read so much. Today, I read this story in the New Yorker that has a woman in it who climbs a tree, but I can't figure exactly why she climbs the tree, so I think the tree must be a symbol, but I'm not sure of what. So symbols are on my mind, and now, out of all of Anne's laundry, it's her husband's shorts that seem to stand for something. There she is, my married twin below me, with the mom we share. Maybe they're talking about me, although I doubt it. They aren't laughing or shaking their heads. I am, as usual, out of the conversation, and sitting in a tree is just about where I often wanted to be when they were discussing the many topics that bored me growing up. Basically, anything my sister was interested in bored me. She grew squash in the backyard. I decided I didn't like the taste of them. She was a good swimmer. I wouldn't get in the water. She married. I didn't. And today, she's hanging up a man's wet shorts. She looks so calm about it, so relaxed, like this is the most perfect part of her day, this stretching her arms up to the sagging clothesline to clip wet shorts to the breeze. I don't know how she can make something so dreary look so peaceful. From where I sit, Anne is starting to look like another version of Mom. Something about that makes me feel lucky to be sitting in a tree. Mom, I say to the tops of the two heads below. Annie. They look up to me in the mulberry, only a little surprised. What are you doing up there, asks Mom, not like it is so strange to see me in a tree, but like she is kind of interested, like she thinks I might be doing research or taking a photograph or looking for something, and she's maybe wondering if she should join me. I'm just thinking. I've been reading this story about a woman who climbs a tree. Well, she's in the park with her kids, actually, and she's thinking about life and stuff, and then she climbs this tree. I can see they're puzzled and not sure whether to take me seriously. Anne is sending me "what are you talking about" signals with her knit-together eyebrows. Mom picks up a shirt, choosing the practical over the puzzle. She snaps wrinkles out of it, kindly shaking off my nonsense. But it's not nonsense. I really ain't figured out the author's point of view. I can teach Treasure Island to eighth graders and make perfect traditional sense, but I really don't know why this 20th century writer has put her character in a tree, especially without describing the actual climbing tree, which seems to me to be at least as interesting as the perspective. Pippi Longstocking, right? Anne calls up to me. She thinks I've been rereading Pippi Longstocking. I'm surprised and pleased she remembers that girl with the freckles and strong arms who used to lift the spirits of our second grade class by lifting horses and living with a monkey. She did climb trees, didn't she, I say. But no, that's not who it was. She had a monkey, not a kid. And what was the name of that monkey of hers anyway? Neither of us can remember. That makes me feel old, and I start to feel the weight of my years on my skinny ankles. I sit so I can let my legs dangle. Forget to go to work, Mom asks. I'm taking a professional day, I say. The faculty is meeting to discuss the curriculum, but I thought it more professional to avoid the jargon. Have you considered how dull it would be if you had to meet once a month with 10 other mothers to decide how to describe how you'd spent your week? Figuring out which words sound important enough would drive you crazy. Mom shrugs. She's heard my lectures on the administrative wasteland before. So, Andy, this woman in the story, why did she climb the tree anyway, asks Anne. Was she being chased? Is she nuts or what? I don't think she's nuts. No one is chasing her. She just decides she needs to sit on a branch. It's a mystery to me, I say. I swing my legs and let my feet bang together and look at my sister's apron so neatly tied behind her neck. Why she would wear an apron to do the laundry is also a mystery to me. What kind of tree was it? Asked my mother. My mother often reminds me that fiction takes place in a real world. I don't know, I say. It's in Brooklyn. What kind of trees grow in Brooklyn? She doesn't remember. She was a busy working girl when she lived in Brooklyn. Ann says it was probably a walnut or a maple or maybe an oak. Why would a writer go out on a limb? I called down to Ann. What is this, a Chicken Road joke? I don't know why, she laughs. Her laundry basket is empty. A slight breeze blows her husband's shorts against her cheek. I can almost feel that wet cloth against her cheek and her affection for it. She reaches to feel the sheet she hung up earlier, and I imagine the inside of her head busy calculating the tasks of the rest of her day. So, Andy, did this woman in the story ever come down out of the tree? Says Anne. Hints between twins can be very subtle to outsiders and look big as newspaper headlines to each other. I don't need eyeglasses to catch Anne's meaning. She's hinting I should come down and join them. I haven't got that far yet, I say to her face tilted up to the mirror of my face. Anne turns to chat with Mom about when irrigation is coming and whether the local Mexican restaurant is crowded and when Brother John is arriving for Christmas, the many topics mothers and daughters have in common at the bottom of trees. I look down at them, and I wonder if my mother's hair will change color with age. I look at my sister and try to decide if that really is what I look like from above. Probably not. Her hair is more full and is always neatly combed. And there's that little bit of extra weight that keeps her from borrowing my pants anymore. And there's that ring on her finger. They continue their conversation, and I climb a little higher, trying to show off. When my foot slips, my fingernails pick up bits of the soft mulberry bark, and the entire weight of my school-teaching body jerks against my skinny arm. I find a foothold and steal a glance out of the corner of my eye to see if they've noticed, but they haven't. The rough crotches of the limbs feel smaller than I remember, and I do remember. I often climb trees through the troubles of my growing up, and this tree in particular because it had the best view. There was a certainty to feeling the weight of my thin body hanging from one arm, pulling so severely at one shoulder and five fingers. You dangle pretty long for a girl, the boy next door told me once, and I punched him, intuitively suspicious about what being a girl meant. I try it again, holding onto a branch overhead and lifting my feet. And it still feels like strength after all these years, how my arm holds, how my wrist carries weight, the tree by fingers. From foot to knee, the inside of my leg slides along the roughness of the bark, feeling for a bump. My toe snags a nub. I trust my balance to that foot and lean into a thick branch. Released from weight, my whole arm tingles from the contrast between flexed and unflexed. Anne and Mom look even smaller, still planted below in the Bermuda grass, still content with words only, while I have to sit to climb trees. Some days, at my teaching desk, when the class is asleep at their books, I look like I'm grading papers, but I'm really daydreaming, seeing the old neighborhood, seeing mulberry trees and the hedges I played Indian behind, and the fields where I stirred ant nests and chased my sister. In this tree, too, I feel like I'm daydreaming, seeing all those places of my history from above, laid out like neatly paragraphed scenes in a book. I look for the horse. 2 yards and a vacant lot away, there used to be a field with a horse in it beside an old trailer where Mr. Bates lived. The trailer, the horse, and Mr. Bates were gone before Anne and I made that transition to talking with the rest of them. Our older brother told us about Mr. Bates and self-importantly described touching the horse. But to us, the horse was only a shape we reached for, each in a parent's arms, opening and closing our baby fingers when Mom said, "See the horsey, Anne? See the horsey, Andy?" The horse was gone before we were old enough to make complete sentences and name things. But the horse stayed in that mental vocabulary between twins, where things are understood more by sense than sentences. "Do you see the horse?" became a way of asking, "Are you okay? Does it make sense to you? Are we still reaching for the same things?" "Fields that are parking lots," I murmur, trying to recover that stretch of dry grass and brown dirt, that dark shape against a wire fence that shook its tail and stamped its feet. I'm in the top of a tree from my youth, and I can't quite see the games I grew up playing because there is a new asphalt parking lot in the way. A story I've been reading, however, is coming into focus. Maybe it takes looking down from above to see how a neighborhood that nurtured children has changed into a bank, a restaurant, an office complex. It takes a small distance to see a sister has changed from a comforting mirror into a stranger's wife. "Is Mr. Bates at home?" asks Anne, quietly penetrating my thoughts like she's sitting on the next branch. I smile down at her and her empty laundry basket. Wife of a stranger or not, I wish I'd helped her hang those shorts. "We're going to lunch. Want to come? Asks my mother. "Sounds interesting," I say. "Where?" "Pablo's. Pablo's, the neighborhood Mexican beanery," I exclaim. and put my foot on the next highest branch and strike a seafaring pose with hand to brow. Let me see if it's crowded. I love the extra tension from below. Plenty of tacos to go around to all hands, I call down. Tortillas blowing in from the north. I pause as if testing the barometric pressure of Mexican food. A big win. Anne groans, guessing a joke about beans is coming. Well, all right already. I'm coming, I say, and begin a quick descent. I do remember this tree. I know I can balance one step only before the branch under my foot will shake. The branch, single step, my knees crack when I bend them, and the little girl in me wants to jump to the ground for the sheer terror of a moment of flying. But my grown woman's head is a little dizzy from my rapid descent of Mulberry. The ground wavers between close and far. I turn to the trunk and wrap my arms around it like an old lady or a fat kid, and slowly, without grace, inch my way down to the grass, scraping pink streaks on the insides of my arms. Did you see the horse? Asks Anne, picking up the conversation we carried on as children whenever I was brave enough to climb higher than her. It's gone, Anne, no more horse. Lots of parking lot, but no horse, I say, standing next to her eye to eye. Some fiction I've been reading, however, is beginning to make more sense. Climbing a tree is one way of seeing what kind of story you're in. On the ground, my mother looks so short, but she still knows how to shoo us along with authority. Let's go, girls, she says. What are we waiting for? She is smiling at her independent single daughter and her quiet married daughter, and I can see we're really 12 years old and still identical after all. I feel a familiar panic, that trapped feeling from people assuming I naturally want the same things Anne wants. But Anne looks happy, her face softened by that connection we can't do anything about anyway. I look at the face so much like my face, and suddenly I'm glad of those identical girls still buried beneath the not-so-identical layers of adults in us. I don't say that, of course, but I do ask my sister Anne if she'd like to do a little reading. I've got a magazine with a good story in it, and she's more than welcome to borrow it.
Our second reader tonight is Ron Hansen. Ron Hansen's published numerous short stories and two novels. Novels are Desperados and The Assassination of Jesse James by the Coward Robert Ford. Our second reader is Ron Hansen.
Thank you. Is that satisfactory, the voice level? I'm going to read four sections from the novel. They're all about 4 or 5 pages long. The first is the beginning of the novel, where I gave all the information I knew at the time about Jesse James. He was growing into middle age and was living then in a bungalow in Woodland Avenue. Green weeds split the porch steps. A wasp nest clung to an attic gable. A rope swing looped down from a dying elm tree, and the ground below it was scuffed soft as flour. Jesse installed himself in a rocking chair and smoked a cigar down in the evening as his wife wiped her pink hands on a cotton apron and reported happily on their two children. Whenever he walked about the house, he carried several newspapers, the Sedalia Democrat, the St. Joseph Gazette, and the Kansas City Times, with a foot-long .44 caliber pistol tucked into a fold. He stuffed flat pencils into his pockets. He played by flipping peanuts to squirrels. He braided yellow dandelions into his wife's yellow hair. He practiced out-of-the-body travel, precognition, sorcery. He sucked raw egg yolks out of their shells and ate grass when sick, like a dog. He would flop open the limp Holy Bible that had belonged to his father, the late Reverend Robert S. James, and would contemplate whichever verses he chanced upon, getting privileged messages from each. The pages were scribbled over with penciled comments and interpretations. The cover was cool to his cheek as a shovel. He scoured for night crawlers after earth-battering rains and flipped them into manure pails until he could chop them into writhing sections and sprinkle them over his garden patch. He recorded sales and trends at the stock exchange, but squandered much of his madcap speculation. He conjectured about foreign relations, justified himself with indignant letters, derided Eastern financiers, seeded tobacco shops and saloons with preposterous gossip about the kitchens of Persia the Queen of England, the marriage rites of the Latter-day Saints. He was a faulty judge of character, a prevaricator, a child at heart. He went everywhere unrecognized and lunched with Kansas City shopkeepers and merchants, calling himself a cattleman or a commodities investor, someone rich and leisured who had the common touch. He was born Jesse Woodson James on September 5, 1847, and was named after his mother's brother, a man who committed suicide. He stood 5 feet 8 inches tall, weighed 155 pounds, and was vain about his physique. Each afternoon, he exercised with weighted yellow pins in his barn, his back bare, his suspenders down, 2 holsters crossed and slung low. He bent horseshoes, he lifted a surrey 20 times from a squat, he wood until it pulverized, he drank vegetable juices and potions. He scraped his sweat off with a butter knife, he dunked his head at morning in a horse water bucket, he waded barefoot through the lank backyard grass with his 6-year-old son hunched on his shoulders and with his trousers rolled up to his knees, snagging garter snakes with his toes and gently letting them go. He smoked but did not inhale cigars. He rarely drank anything stronger than beer. He never philandered nor strayed from his wife nor had second thoughts about his marriage. He never swore in the presence of ladies nor raised his voice with children. His hair was fine and chestnut brown and recurrently barbered, but it had receded so badly since his 20s that he feared eventual baldness and therefore rubbed his temples with onions and myrtleberry oil in order to stimulate growth. He scissored his 2-inch sunlight and beard according to the fashion then associated with physicians. His eyes were blue except for iris pyramids of green, as on the back of a dollar bill, and his eyebrows so deeply he scarcely even squinted or shied his eyes from a glare. His nose was unlike his mother's or brother's, not long and preponderant, no proboscis, but upturned a little and puttied, a puckish, low-born nose, the ruin, he thought, of his otherwise gallantly handsome countenance. 4 of his molars were crowned with gold, and they gleamed sometimes when he smiled. He had 2 incompletely healed bullet holes in his chest and another in his thigh. He was missing the nub of his left middle finger and was cautious lest that mutilation be seen. He'd had a boil excised from his groin and it left a white star of skin. A getaway horse had jerked from him and fractured his ankle in a saddle stirrup, so that his foot mended a little crooked and registered barometric changes. He also had a condition that was referred to as granulated eyelids, and it caused him to blink more than usual, as if he found creation slightly more than he could accept. He was a Democrat. He was left-handed. He had a high, thin low of a voice, a contralto that could twang annoyingly like a catgut guitar whenever he was excited. He owned 5 suits, which was rare then, and colorful brocaded vests and cravats. He wore a 32-inch belt and a 14.5-inch collar. He favored red wool socks. He rubbed his teeth with his finger after meals. He was persistently vexed by insomnia and therefore experimented with a vast number of soporifics, which did little besides increasing his fascination with pharmacological remedies. He could neither multiply nor divide without error, and much of his science was superstition. He could list the many begotten of Abraham and the 66 books of the King James Bible. He could recite psalms and poems in a stentorian voice with suitable histrionics. He could sing religious hymns so convincingly that he worked for a month as a choir master. He was marvelously informed about current events. And yet he thought incense was made from the bones of saints. That leather continued to grow if not died. That if he concentrated hard enough, his body's electrical currents could stun leak as he bathed. He could intimidate like King Henry VIII. He could be reckless or serene, rational or lunatic from 1 minute to the next. If he made an entrance, heads turned in his direction. If he strode down an aisle, store clerks backed away. If he neared animals, they retreated. Rooms seemed hotter when he was in them. Rains fell straighter, clocks slowed. Sounds were amplified. His enemies would not have been much surprised if he produced horned owls out of beer bottles or made candles out of his fingers. He considered himself a Southern loyalist and a guerrilla in a civil war that never ended. He regretted neither his robberies nor the 17 murders that he laid claim to, but he would brood about his slanders and slights, his callow need for attention, his overweening vaingloriousness. And he was excessively genteel and polite in order to disguise what he thought was vulgar, primitive, and depraved in his origins. Sicknesses made him smell blood each morning. He visited rooms at night. He sometimes heard children in the fruit cellar, He waded into prairie weird at the horizon. He had seen another summer under in Kansas City, Missouri, and on September 5th in the year 1881, he was 34 years old. I'm skipping ahead to December of 1881. He has met Bob Ford. Bob Ford participated in the last train robbery that the James Hick gang ever committed in Blue Cut, Missouri. And Bob Ford has managed to insinuate himself as one of the members of the gang and one of Jesse's confidants to a certain extent. Jesse has stopped by after a ruinous Christmas dinner with his family, where his mother thoroughly dominated him. So he decides to go visit the Ford family at their Christmas. Charlie Ford, Bob's brother, was with Jesse at the Christmas celebration, and he's accompanying Jesse over to the Ford house. Charlie has just come in the door. Bob was in a chair, wan and shyly startled, his arms beneath the oak table that, like a schoolboy sticking gum. Charlie asked, "Is Dick here?" "Kansas City." "Anything you should hide?" "Jesse," Bob said. Charlie nodded and removed his coat. "Don't let him see us so much as wink at each other. He's suspicious as a dang coyote, and he don't trust you one iota." Bob lifted a cocked revolver from under the table and carefully let the hammer click forward. "I guess that makes us even." Then Jesse came inside in his reddish-brown beaver coat, frost in his dark brown mustache and beard, moisture in his eyes from the cold, and communicated amicably with Bob, joshing as he jigged at the stove fire, creating Christmas cheer. Then, as Charlie vagrantly talked about the weather, Jesse played truant and roamed the second floor of the house, nosing into closets and cabinets, seeking evidence. His footfalls overhead were faint. Bob presumed that Jesse gently pushed the shut door so that they swung ever so gracefully into the night of the rooms. Bob toned lips to stop Charlie from speaking, and the two brothers listened as Jesse knocked a chair a-kilter and carefully righted it. Bob said, "Dick might be making arrangements with Henry H. Craig." "Oh, and who would that be?" Charlie said. Martha came into the kitchen, fastening a yellow robe around herself. Her auburn hair was wrecked with sleep, and her complexion was very pale. She murmured, "Are you telling him?" "Maybe you better," said Bob. "I'll stand at the door." Charlie said in a constrained voice, "This is mysterious." Martha poured water into a tumbler and turned with it near her mouth. "It's just a guess on my part." She sipped water and put the tumbler down. "Mr. Craig is an attorney and a Kansas City police commissioner. Has an office in the Times building. Dick said he was going to give Maddie a Christmas gift. My guess is he's actually going to see Mr. Craig and give him you two for the reward." Bob bent into the sitting room and craned to see the chairs. Jesse was apparently motionless somewhere above them, letting his fancies run like red-eyed ferret, letting the experienced air educate his senses. Bob could just make out his sister's words as she informed Charlie about the governor's reward, about plea bargaining and immunity, about exoneration. She sipped water and told him Craig could only negotiate for Jackson County, so she and Bob were considering a visit with Governor Crittenden to see if he couldn't guarantee the Ford brothers wouldn't be prosecuted. In exchange for that, they'd promised the governor to help him capture Jesse James. Bob leaned his back against the kitchen doorframe and saw Charlie contemplating his toes, his face temporarily 60 years old. "Charlie," Bob whispered. His brother raised his brown eyes. "You can forget about Wood Height and about Jesse getting back at us. You won't go to jail for your train robberies, and you'll be a rich man come spring." You're both talking too fast for me. I can't get it straight in my mind." Martha said, "Just let us take care of it then." They listened to the crump of Jesse's slow descent on the staircase, and Bob started to move out of the kitchen. Charlie said, "He'll kill us if he catches wind of it. He'll cut our throats in our sleep. He's already put away Ed Miller, said so like it was something piddly he'd done." Bob sauntered into the sitting room and saw Jesse crouched on the stairs, scratching his thumbnail on a riser. Jesse considered the nail and then sniffed it. "Is this blood?" Bob sat nonchalantly in the rocker. "Could be. Clarence Height was here for a week and never could get the best of that miserable cough. Could be he was spitting blood and had himself an accident." Jesse rubbed his thumb on the seat of his trousers. "Don't suppose it's consumption, do you?" "Oh, Lord, I hope not. I never gave it a thought." "In England, they eat lemons. 12 per day isn't too few." Jesse removed his broad hat and attended to the almost inaudible conference near the kitchen stove. And they sip boiled water at bedtime. He turned to Bob. They talking about me? Bob rocked and smiled. Probably. You're the topic of conversations in every part of the country. Jesse extricated himself from his heavy coat and lay on a sofa with his hat. Did I ever tell you about meeting Mark Twain? No. He was in this country store, and I recognized him, of course, and I went over to shake the man's hand and congratulate him on his good riding. I said, you're Mark Twain, ain't you? And he nodded, said yes he was, and I said, guess you and I are about the greatest in our line. He couldn't very well agree since he didn't know who I was, so he asked, and I say, Jesse James, and scoot on right out of there. Here Telly still talks about that. They say you go over to Europe, and the only Americans they know all for certain are Mark Twain and yours truly. I'm not surprised, Bob said. Jesse seemed to peer at Bob through a jeweler's bifocals. Got a bullet hole in your bedroom door. Oh? Could have been put there when old man Harbison ran the place, I guess. You never can tell, Bob said. If you look, you'll find holes in the kitchen, too. Gun cleaning accidents, maybe. Jesse batted the Christmas ornaments on a measly spruce that was wired into a tin bucket, and Wilbur from the privy rigorously abrading his sleeves. Jesse asked, Dick Little come by yet? Nope. You know why he hasn't? Maybe Matty's got him on a short leash these days. I've got my own theory. I say it's on account of him and Wood having to run in like they did in Kentucky. It's my theory he killed my cousin, and he's scared he'll meet me here. Bob gripped the rocking chair arms and tried to appear simply inquisitive. Jesse said, I'd appreciate it if you'd spread the word that I'm offering a reward for Dick. $1,000, dead or alive. And let people know I'd prefer him dead. You're saying that in the heat of passion, Bob said. Big Wilbur came in with a jar of honey and a finger in his mouth. Merry Christmas, Jess. $1,000, Jesse said. Bob indicated the sheet that skirted the Christmas tree and asked, Did you notice there was a present up there for you? Jesse beamed. You're teasing. He stooped under a cincture of popcorn blossoms sewn with a thread and retrieved a cardboard box that was the size of a brick and wrapped in blue tissue paper. He shook the box and the contents clobbered inside. Heavy. I can't wait to see your eyes twinkle. Wilbur grinned at his brother. It's a gun, ain't it, Bob? You'll see soon enough. Jesse ripped off the paper and the box flap and with childish astonishment withdrew a black ironwork model of a salacious naked woman, her arms crossed beneath her head, her legs lewdly cloven and lifted. It's a body bootjack, Bob said. I've wished I've owned one 1,000 times. Well, now you do. Jesse stroked the woman's round breast with his thumb and blushed as he smiled. I love Christmas. I can see that. He imitated shame. But I don't have anything for you. I never dreamed. Your friendship is plenty. Charlie slunk in from the kitchen and then warily approached Jesse to examine the articulation of the ironwork. He asked his brother, What is it? It's a body bootjack, he said. It's something I'll cherish always, said Jesse. Then we both have something to cherish, said Bob. Jesse remained on the farm that Christmas night and Bob remained awake. The moon was in the window and a window of moonlight was on the floor so that Jesse was unkenneled, released from the room's darkness and there on the cot like a man in a coffin. A man collected in an arrangement. Bob sat in his bed in his gray underwear, his wrists crossed, his ankles clasped, incapable of movement. He could see that there was a gun on the nightstand to his left and could imagine its cold nickel inside his grip. Its 2-pound weight reached out and aimed, but he couldn't even maneuver toward it. It was like a name he couldn't remember. He was a boy again, a rube. There were connections he was missing, and there across the room was Jesse, placid and sovereign, certain of both heaven and earth. His color in the night was the blue in veins of marble, and the handsome head that rested on the pillow was appetitive and proud and pleased with itself. And even then, with a man asleep, with his acute senses unattended, his keen reflexes numbed and slowed, the exact location of his fire possibly forgotten, Bob could not screw up the courage to act. It was as if some spell or sorcery had rendered him meek, infirm, confounded. He could contrive many ways of snaring Jesse. He could invent 1,000 deaths. But Bob feared it would always come to this. He would see a chance, and then he'd interpret it and speculate on its consequences. He would ponder each option in particular, and soon the opportunity would pass away, or qualms would overmaster him, conscience make him impotent. Bob consoled himself with the thought that the next time he would not stall so long. Later, when Jesse was sickened or sorely distracted or the right situation presented itself, when Bob had mastered his courage and was not so susceptible to uncertainties. Bob was not yet 20, after all, while Jesse was 34 and in physical decline. Each calendar week subtracted from Jesse the powers that Bob accrued. So Bob could afford to wait if Jesse would only let him. And that, of course, he did. With that, Bob slid under the covers and closed his eyes in imitation of Jesse, and he woke next at sunrise to noises in the kitchen. Charlie still was left, but the cot across from Bob was vacated, and downstairs a tea kettle piped once before it was removed from the stove. Bob skulked down the staircase and across the sitting room, Tom foolishly tiptoeing to the kitchen entrance and peeking around the door jamb. Jesse had amassed his suit clothes next to the butter churn and skidded a laundry boiler into the pantry, where he stood naked in 2 inches of steaming water, wringing a soaped washcloth over his skull, spitting the water that trickled into his mouth. He didn't notice Bob in the room. He scrubbed his elbow and knuckles with a tile brush and rinsed his arm and coughed twice and then again until he was racked like a chain smoker for more than a minute. And Bob smiled as he thought, "You're old, Jess. You are dying even now." His skin was white as sheep's wool and the scars on his chest were red as slaughter. He was muscular in the back and shoulders, and sinews crossed his pectorals like laces, and his biceps bunched when he lifted his wrist to tenderly examine it. But his ankle was knurled where he'd broken it. Varices mapped his calves and thighs. His buttocks were flat as books. There were rows of skin at his kidneys and neck. His ribs could be easily numbered. His shoulder clicked when he circled it. He bent with apparent pain. The many injuries of a reckless career had made him prematurely decrepit, as ancient as the Noah that Ham spied on in the tent. Jesse coughed into his fist once more and swished his hand in the water at his feet, and then lifted an ocean shell ashtray and sacredly doused the crown of his head. It was then that he saw Bob Ford and said, "Go away." "Never crossed your mind that I was here, and it's been nigh on to 3 minutes at least." "You sure of that?" Jesse stepped from the laundry tub onto a red flannel shirt on the floor. He covered his face with a dish towel and then wrinkled his dark brown hair with it as he smiled insincerely at Bob. "Maybe I was fooling you. Maybe we're playing cat and mouse. I've never seen you without your guns, neither." Jesse towed a bath towel off a chair and revealed, almost incidentally, a 12-inch Remington revolver on the seat. "Don't happen more than once a year." But Bob simpered with self-satisfaction. "Is it no one can sneak up on Jesse James as the way it used to be?" Jesse shawled himself in a white bath towel and sat down on the chair to soothe his feet in the laundry tub. "And now you think you know otherwise. Maybe that's just what I wanted. I'm making fun of all, is all, you understand. I wouldn't dream of mocking you or causing you any ill feelings." Jesse rounded forward under the towel and cozied his feet in the bathwater. It was as if no one else were around and Jesse was once again alone and at ease with his meditations. He said, "I can't figure it out. Do you want to be like me? Do you want to be me?" I'm going to skip ahead now till April 1882. Bob and Charlie Ford are living with Jesse James in St. Joseph, Missouri, where Jesse is living under the name of Thomas Howard. And it's April 1st. Saturday introduced summer weather state. The skies were blue, the sun insistent, the temperature close to 80 at noon. The river flashed light from its rills and currents, and Zee could look up from her scullery work and see Kansas shimmer like a reflection in water. The Fords removed the storm windows, and Jesse raised each sash so that sweet air could stir through the rooms. But they were too lazy or lumpish to attach screens, so flies crawled over the rising loaves, and birds flew into the rooms. Jesse went to the market with Tim and Mary and came back at 4 with a crate of groceries and a black box clamped under his right arm. He kissed Zee and rubbed her fanny and asked her how she was feeling. She saw that he'd subjected his skull to a barber. A smear of white talcum powder was on his neck and his chestnut hair smelled of lilac water. But he looked much handsomer now than when she married him, a quality of aging that she'd often envied in men. Jesse sought Cousin Bob and she told him she thought Bob was resting in the children's room. Sunshine was diagonal in the room and curtains flirted in the air. Wasn't sure what woke him. He pivoted in the child's bed and saw Jesse in a spindle chair, peering at him with great interest. Jesse said, "I never learned what your nationality was." "How long have you been studying me?" Bob asked. "You look French." Bob rolled to a sitting position. My grandfather married a French girl in New Orleans. He was with the Virginia Volunteers in the War of 1812. I guess I take after my grandma. You're gonna break a lot of hearts. Bob arched an eyebrow. How do you mean? Jesse revealed a black box from behind his back and reached it over to Bob. It's a present. Bob raised it and reckoned what it was. Heavy, he said. You gonna look inside? Why are you being so nice to me? You gave me that body boot jack. This is my Christmas gift to you. The wooden lid was nailed shut. Bob crammed a coin in the interstices and twisted it until the lid released. It's April Fool's Day, you know. Isn't a joke, said Jesse. In the box, nestled in red velvet, was a pearl-handled 44 caliber revolver, a new model Smith & Wesson number 3, with a 6.5-inch nickel barrel. Bob beamed at Jesse and said, such extravagance, and then turned the revolver to admire it. Doesn't that nickel shine, though? It's more than I could hope for, said Bob. He clicked the chamber around, cocked and released the hammer, cocked the hammer and aimed the revolver at a red ball on the floor, investigated the play in the trigger, squeezed the trigger until a steel hammer snapped forward, listened to the mechanisms as he re-cocked the revolver at his ear, straightened his right arm and shut his left eye, skated his thumb across the serial number, measured the full length, 12 inches. I want a gunsmith to engrave this, some sentence with our two names on it, in the city, in the year of presentation. It'll be a prize that can be carried on from one generation to the next. I figure that granddaddy Colt of yours might blow into fragments next time you squeeze the trigger. Bob grinned and said, you might have something there. He substituted the new model Smith & Wesson for the tarnished revolver in the script leather holster that he then buckled and let slant across his right rear pocket. He slapped it out like a gunfighter, snugged it, slapped it out again. The gun chuckled against the rigid leather, but after repeated pulls and replacements, it made no more noise than a man's swallow. Z called from the dining room, Jesse, you ready for supper? Pretty soon, sweetheart. Bob said, I might be too excited to eat. Jesse smiled broadly and rose from the spindle chair. You know what John Newman Edwards once wrote about me? He said I didn't trust two men in 10,000 and was even cautious around them. The government sort of run me ragged, you see. I'm sort of going a long way around the barn to say, I've been feeling cornered and just plain ornery of late, and I'd be pleased if you'd accept the gun as my way of apologizing. Heavens know I'd be ornerier if I was in your position. No, I haven't been acting correctly. I can't hardly recognize myself sometimes when I'm greased. I go on journeys out of my body and look at my red hands, my mean face, and I get critical. Who is that man who's gone so wrong? Why all that killing and evil behavior? I've been becoming a problem to myself. I figure if I can get you right, I'll be just that much closer to me. Bob looked at the man in bewilderment and couldn't find the words for an answer, so he said, I need to wash my hands if supper's on. The guns made them feel sort of public. Go ahead, the man said, and graciously opened the door. Bob exited from the children's room and smiled meekly at Z as he entered the kitchen and leaned on the counter for a moment. He spilled pitcher water into a pan, and as he sank his hands in it, he listened to Jesse greet his children, listened to chairs sliding away from the dining room table and sliding underneath it again. Jesse began to say grace without him, and Bob raised a brick of yellow soap to his nose, smelling its ingredients, rainwater, cell soda, unslaked lime, tallow, rosin, salt. The last section I'll read from you is the day of Jesse's death, April 3rd, 1882. Much later, Bob would remember that he woke at sunrise on April 3rd, looking at a racehorse named Skyrocket. Charlie was climbing into a rough wool shirt that he wore whenever he worked with the animals. Bob dangled his fingers to the floor and walked them over his gun. Z was already at the stove, and Bob could see steam escape from a covered saucepan in shy phrases of smoke. Tim was in the children's room, annoying his little sister. Bob would recall that Jesse then came out of the master bedroom and scolded the children for pestering each other when it wasn't more than seven. He wore the crisp celluloid collar and the dazzlingly white linen shirt that he stole from the Kansas Hotel highboy, and he adjusted the silk cravat in a looking glass that revealed a section of shut door, a chair woven with rushes, a marred wall with the heights of Tim and Mary designated in crayon. Bob slithered from under the covers in order to conceal an erection and struggled his legs into nut-brown trousers, then struggled his stocking feet into boots that were so in the heels that his ankles caved out. Charlie clumped to the stables via the front door, and the screen door clapped off a sinking mist of street dust. Jesse buttoned a black cashmere Prince Albert coat over a vest and over his two crossed holsters and guns. He informed Bob without nastiness that he could stay inside and sleep some more, and he walked out into sunlight just as Zee angrily banged shut the oven door, muttering, "Oh, shoot." Bob tucked in a yellow shirt and called, "Is that you making all that smoke?" He saw Zee flip some burnt cottage biscuits from a blackened baking pan and say to no one, "This ornery stove." He finger-combed his ginger-brown hair in the looking glass and slipped through gray oven smoke to go out to the privy. He stepped over puddles that an overnight rain had put in the yard, and he closed the privy door behind him. The temperature forecast was 80 degrees, and already the April morning seemed as warm and moist as cooking vapors. Mary crouched outside with a coffee grinder that she'd ruined with sand, Tim himself on a rope swing that rasped against the sycamore bole. Bob walked over to the backyard cistern buttoning his fly, and the cistern pump brayed mulishly when he worked the iron handle. Charlie came up from the stables and scraped off manure on a rusted rake that was forgotten in the grass. And though Bob said good morning to him, his only gesture of recognition was to slouch down the slope of the yard a ways and squat for some time inside cigarette smoke. Jesse caught the swing set and gentled Tim down to a stop, and then the two strolled down Confusion Hill for the subscription newspapers. Cold water that was slightly orange splashed into Bob's lifted white enamel bowl and spotted his trouser cuffs and boots. He brought the water to his face gratefully, as a man might a sweetheart's fingers, and he imagined without willing it the gruesome fish he'd caught in September. When he looked up, Zee was peering at him through the porch screen. "How much do you want to eat?" she asked. Fingers, and he imagined without willing it the gruesome fish he'd caught in September. When he looked up, Zee was peering at him through the porch screen. "How much do you want to eat?" she asked. "Just a smidgen," Bob said, and got up on his legs. "I'm feeling sort of peculiar." He pushed Mary in the swing for a while, responding to a two-year-old's questions, and then grew weary of that, flung her higher than before, and straggled into the front yard where he leaned over the white picket fence to look down Lafayette Street. Sunlight flashed off the city's windows. The railroad yards to the west were ceilinged with smoke. The river moved with the slow advancement of blood. He lingered there for 5 minutes or so, his thumbs cocked by his pockets. He could have been a man at the races, a gambler with money on skyrocket. Craig and Timberlake would be sitting at breakfast, perhaps, making prep for Tuesday, eating sweet croissants. Craig would enrich his coffee with cream. A crew would be in the freight car, strewing straw for the deputy's animals. Bob watched the great man and his child climb the steep ascent of the sidewalk with shoes on their feet and grand aspirations and a common language between them. But Bob figured that only meant they were slightly more intricate animals. It meant they were given more mechanisms than guns. Bob saw Jesse move a cigar in his mouth and squinted his eyes from the smoke. He said, "How come you're looking so interested?" Bob asked, "Do you think it's intelligent to go outside like that so all creation can see your guns?" Jesse ignored him and threw the cigar so that it sparked and rolled, screwing smoke. And then he rushed his daughter, monstering, catching Mary as she ran squealingly to the screen door and swinging the girl around so wildly her right stockinged foot lost its shoe. Zee called everyone in to breakfast that was cooling, and Mary hugged her father's neck as he gracefully walked to the dining room. Tim carelessly threw down the rolled newspapers in the sitting room next to his sister's high chair. Bob slid open a brown paper sleeve and spilled out the Kansas City Times, seeing instantly a story about the arrest and confession of Dick Little. Charlie slouched into the dining room late, looking meek and afflicted, lying about some complaint with the horses, to which Jesse paid scant attention. Bob slipped the newspaper under a shawl and strapped on the gun he had been given, tying the leather holster to his thigh with a string. Zee called Bob again, slightly irritably, saying everything was getting cold, and Bob seated himself across from Jesse, accidentally scarring the chair with his gun. Zee jellied a biscuit for Mary and mentioned she'd invited a girl from across the street to go shopping with her for Easter clothes that afternoon. She asked Jesse to give her some money, and he removed $2 $5 bills from a small roll secured with a rubber band. She asked if Jesse wanted some sandwiches for his journey. She asked if he'd come back for the Holy Thursday services. Jesse frowned at her old son, who was staring blankly at the sunshine, wool gathering, his oatmeal spoon in his mouth. "What do you think goes on in that noggin of his?" "Nothing," said Charlie Ford. Jesse laughed. "I was referring to his mind, not yours." Bob snickered cravenly, and Jesse looked askance at him. He then stood from his chair and fetched the newspapers that Tim had abandoned on the sofa, almost missing the Kansas City Times that was incompletely concealed by a shawl. He sat again with solemnity and stirred a spoon in his cup, swirling ghosts from the coffee. Bob noticed every motion, every physical event, the crease in the man's brow, the fret in his reading eyes, the stain on a finger from the cigars he smoked. Bob slid the second newspaper around and scanned the items on the front page: legislation and politics, advertisements for curatives and clothes, the outrages visited on a young woman in Memphis, the shedding of innocent blood. A man in Grandview was ruled insane, a farm was lost to incendiaries. It was the 22nd anniversary of the start of the Pony Express. Jesse unfastened his Prince Albert coat and snared it over his guns. Tim excused himself from the table with a rasher of bacon in his mouth, and Mary climbed down from her high chair after him. Jesse flattened the Kansas City Times over the newspaper he'd finished and lowered his crossed arms to scour the articles. "Hello now," he said. "The surrender of Dick Little," Charlie said, perhaps too urgently. "You don't say so." Jesse lifted a coffee cup close to his mouth and stared at Bob through the vapors. "Young man, I asked you yesterday, and you said you didn't know anything about Dick." "And I don't." Jesse moved his finger down the page, guiding his eyes as he read. "It's very strange," he said. He made no other comment as he continued to the conclusion. Z was scraping the children's breakfast plates in the kitchen and immersing them in soaked dishwater. They thudded together with the wooden sound of a muscular heart pumping blood. Jesse sipped some coffee without looking up from the newspaper. He said, "It says here Dick surrendered 3 weeks ago." He glanced at Bob with misgiving. "You must have been right there in the neighborhood." "Apparently they kept it secret," Bob said. Jesse slumped back in the chair with his fingers knitted over his stomach and glared at Bob and then Charlie. "It looks sort of fishy to me." Bob said, "If I get to Kansas City soon, I'm going to ask somebody about it." And then he left the dining room with his right hand on his gun. He raised the Venetian blinds and the screenless sitting room windows and reacquainted himself with the rocking chair, his body fidgeting. Tim hunkered down on the stoop outside, coercing the crank on the coffee grinder. His little sister squatted beside him, pushing her pale dress down between her thighs, stabbing at the earth with a crooked spoon and repeating, for some reason, "Don't." Jesse retrieved some remedy from the medicine cabinet and pantry and murmured privately with his wife. Charlie walked into the sitting room and remarked in the sultry weather, said the afternoon would be hot as a pistol. He sat on the mattress and looped his holster off the bedpost, looking significantly at Bob as he put it on. Jesse paused at the sitting room entrance, as if to reconscheme, and then proceeded across the tasseled green rug with a long linen duster over one forearm, the other cradling packed saddlebags and a folded newspaper that carried a gun. Bob jumped up from the rocker and it reared and rode, clubbing the floor, until he could still the chair with his hand. Jesse asked, "You two ready?" And Charlie said, "I will be by noon." And Bob strode over to the hanging straw portfolio, and as he snatched out a children's book, he could feel Jesse glare at his gun. Bob shouldered into the floral wallpaper and vagrantly read to himself the first sentence of chapter one. The kitchen had quieted down from the bustle and confusion of midday. Jesse rammed a raised window sash higher, making the snug fittings moan. Clouds were shipping in and accumulating, and most of the eastern sky was the color of nails. "It's an awfully hot day," Jesse James said, and Charlie thought so much of his earlier statement that he said once again it was going to be hot as a pistol. Jesse took off his Prince Albert coat, and Bob concentrated on the man, stowing fibers and how they grew among some magazines. Jesse folded the fine black coat on the oak bed, and then removed a 6-button black vest that was extravagantly brocaded with red stitching. Charlie shambled over to the screen door to scan Lafayette Street. Sunlight streaked off Jesse's 2 revolvers. He leaned on the windowsill and gazed at the skittish weather. A suspender was twisted once across the back of an iron shirt that coins of sweat made the color of smoke. He proclaimed in a sentence that seemed composed just for Bob, I guess I'll take my pistols off for fear the neighbors will spy them if I walk out into the yard. Charlie instantly turned from the screen door with vexation in his face and saw his kid brother's right thumb twitch as Bob lowered his hand to his gun. Jesse unbuckled the two crossed holsters with their two unmatched revolvers and carefully placed them on the mattress as if creating some exhibit, and it seemed to Bob that the man was pretending. Each motion seemed stressed, adorned, theatrical, an unpolished actor's version of conchalance. Jesse lent his attention to the racehorse named Skyrocket and said, "That picture is awful dusty," and withdrew from a wicker sewing basket a furniture duster that was made from the blue-eyed feathers of peacocks. He could easily reach the picture by standing, but he skidded the rush-bottomed chair across the rug and climbed onto it as if the floor were inclined and uncertain. Bob slunk from the wall in order to stand between Jesse and the two revolvers. He shook loose his fingers like a gunfighter and instructed his brother with scared eyes as Jesse stood above them and feathered the walnut frame. Charlie winked and the two Fords slipped out their guns. Bob was the speedier and had his 44 extended straight out from his right eye as Charlie was still raising his, and Jesse appeared to hear the three clicks as the Smith and Wesson was cocked because he slightly swiveled his head with authentic surprise, straying his left hand toward a gun that he'd forgotten was gone. Then Robert Ford's 44 ignited, and a red stamp seemed to spin against the outlaw's chestnut brown hair 1 inch to the rear of his right ear, and his left eyebrow socked into the glassed watercolor of Skyrocket. Gunpowder and gun noise filled the room, and Jesse groaned as a man does in his sleep, and then sagged from his knees and tilted over and smacked the floor like a great animal, shaking the house with his fall. He looked at the ceiling, his fingers curled and uncurled, his mouth worked at making words, and then the two Ford brothers saw he was dying. Charlie leaped out the window and into the yard, and as Z rushed into a room that was blue with smoke, Bob slowly retreated and straddled the sill. She screamed, "What have you done?" And the boy looked as if he wanted to apologize, but couldn't. Z knelt and cried, "Jesse, Jesse, Jesse," and cradled his skull in her apron and smothered his right ear in petticoats that soaked red with his blood. Tim was at the screen door, seeing everything, and Bob was still crouched at the sitting room window, gawking at the man. She asked with anguish, "Bob, have you done this?" And he answered, "A God that I didn't." The man sighed and grew heavy on her legs. His eyes seemed yellow, his muscles slack. The blood was wide as a table. He made a syllable like God, and then everything inside him stopped. Charlie skulked inside the cottage to collect the Ford's two hats and riding coats and to look again at the man they'd shot. He told Z. James the pistol went off accidentally. Then Charlie was outside again, and the two Fords ran down Confusion Hill, their coats flying, cutting through yards and down alleys until they achieved the American Telegraph office. Wentz was sent to Sheriff Timberlake, Henry H. Craig, and Governor Thomas Crittenden, an abbreviated message that read, "I have killed Jesse James, Bob Ford." Thank you.